Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find time to sit down, make progress on a book we've been trying to read. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books and distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You still get all of the most important takeaways, the crucial information from each book, but you do so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting. You can do it at the gym. You can do it on your way to work. Now, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. Why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist today totally free and get access to the library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/ROF. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. On today's show, Ivan Briscoe from the International Crisis Group will be here to explain the current political tension in Venezuela and how we got there. Soumya Shankar from The Intercept will join us to discuss the disturbing ties between Democratic presidential contender Tulsi Gabbard and her support from and for Hindu nationalists. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to break down the biggest news of the week, and Alex Lawson from Social Security Works will be here to catch us up on the expansion of health care and Social Security and why these two issues should be part of the focus of the 2020 presidential campaign. Have you signed up for the Ring of Fire Radio podcast yet? Well, you can help support this show by going to ROFpodcast.com. You can sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, you can become a member and help keep us on the air. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, this week, interesting week. Obviously, this is the government has reopened this week, and Donald Trump caved in a big way. That cave became more prominent as the week went on, and the reluctance of the Republicans to get involved with another government shutdown became more prominent as the week went on. And we will circle back to that. But I want to talk about another development this week that, in some respects, is sort of a sideshow, but in many respects, I think it captures the essence of where Democratic politics is today. In some respects, also captures the essence of what is very problematic about politics broadly today. And there was almost, and I'm talking about the Howard Schultz, bonanza this week. For three or four days, this guy was on every single major network program that you could be on, it seems like, that wasn't, you know, a fictional show. 60 Minutes, he was on The View, he was on every cable news outlet, he was interviewed by all the major players. They wrote about him in the Times and the Post. And I have a feeling a lot of people are like, who is that? And he is the former CEO of Starbucks, so a very successful owner of a coffee shop. And the big news, he's contemplating running for president. And we were all sort of treated to this guy's rollout, which was disastrous as far as I could tell. I don't know how it could be anything assessed as anything other than disastrous, but it told a lot of stories, this rollout. What, give me your take on it, because I know you wrote about it.
Yeah, I did. I mean, look, first of all, you know, why this guy is getting this level of attention when it seems to me that everybody's running for president, I don't know. And furthermore, we already had another billionaire in the race, more or less. We have Michael Bloomberg, who has made it very, you know, clear that he is very seriously thinking of running in the Democratic primary. But Howard Schultz comes along, and he is somehow, you know, fated like he's the second coming in the media, which I think says a lot about the media, and we should probably talk about that as well. But I think that the Schultz, you know, story, the fact that he came along and said immediately that he was contemplating a run as a third party or an independent or whatever outside the party system, I think that's what got Democrats shaken up, because there's been plenty of polling that suggests that if he were to run, because of his attitudes mostly on social issues, he would likely pull from Democrats. And that is, you know, obviously the whole Democratic Party is terrified of the idea of another 4 years of Donald Trump as a result of, particularly as a result of something like this. And this vanity run of his, which I really think it is. I mean, like, I suspect you and I agree on this. I don't think Howard Schultz is going anywhere as an actual, you know, candidate. But what if he decides that he gets just enough to stay in the race? Obviously, he has the money to put himself on the ballot. I mean, and this is why the billionaire part of this is so threatening. You know, if it's just some guy, no one would care. But he's got, what is he, worth $3 billion or something.
Right.
He can finance this himself, and he can put himself on the ballot and siphon off just enough votes to potentially put Donald Trump back in the White House. So, you know, that's what has them scared. But as a someone with an actual constituency, it's a joke. I mean, this is one of the perennial sort of, you know, tropes among, you know, rich guys and plenty of people in the Washington Beltway media that believes that somehow or another most people in the country really just want to be, quote, in the middle. He's calling himself a centrist, as if I'm in the center. You can split the difference between the Republicans and Donald Trump on the one hand and these crazy socialist Democrats on the other. And so he's supposedly, there's all these people who are just yearning for some exceedingly boring billionaire who has absolutely nothing new to say about anything to play that role and be the president, the daddy president that we're all waiting for. And, you know, there is no evidence that that is true. The independents in this country break into both parties pretty neatly. There isn't a constituency for people who, you know, are so in the center that they can't find a home in either one of the parties. And, you know, this idea is just, it's some wish fulfillment on the part of certain members. And in this case, you know, it looks like it's some people, mostly Republican advisors and consultants who maybe have talked to him, and now we find out there's some Obama people in there,
yeah,
too, that are going to be working for him.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money going to be exchanged. So, you know, and one thing I find interesting about him, though, is that in these first days of the rollout of his potential campaign, and he's selling a book, too, is this, you know, what he's doing basically is trashing Democrats. I mean, it's pretty clear,
right,
that the reason he's running is because he does not like the idea of being taxed or doing any kind of the sort of, you know, fundamental rethinking that's going on in the Democratic Party about the economy and how it's working. I mean, I haven't heard him say much against Donald Trump except, you know, well, he's not qualified to be president, which is kind of funny since, you know, he has as many qualifications going in as Trump did. I mean,
right,
you know, at least Trump had dabbled in politics back in the day. I mean, he'd run on the Reform Party ticket for a few minutes back in 2000. I mean, this guy's not coming in with any particular political experience. So anyway, you know, this is a very, very interesting thing. And, you know, here we have him and Bloomberg, who He's also kind of trashing the left of the Democratic Party, but at least he's doing it from within the party itself. So this argument can be had, and we can see it play itself out in the primaries, and they can, you know, go head to head. He can face off with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and we'll see what happens. But you know, this idea that they're going to bring in, you know, fly in some boring billionaire and he's going to save us. I mean, have we not seen the effects of hiring some inexperienced business guy? I mean, I would have thought that, you know, Trump would have, you know, actually that experiment would have been shown to have
failed.
Oh,
yeah. I think
that we might want to try something else.
I don't think anybody has learned that lesson. But let's take a quick break. When we come back, I got a couple more thoughts on this because it has been a fascinating couple of days to watch this roll out. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, when we broke, we were talking about the nascent, maybe it's hopefully past, Howard Schultz moment. He, of course, is the former CEO of Starbucks, and he released a book this week entitled something to the effect of From the Ground Up, How America Can Be Really Great Again, or something to that effect. The ground up being, of course, a play on the fact that he made his money by selling coffee. And we were talking about, well, there's two things that struck me this week. One is, you mentioned Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire who's already contemplated jumping into the Democratic race. And I thought it was very funny when Bloomberg tweeted out, like, hey, I refused in 2016 to run because I didn't want to help Trump win. And he's basically saying, like, you can't cut ahead of me in the self-aggrandizement department. I'm a bigger billionaire than you are. And if I stood down, despite my massive ego and narcissism, you have to step down too, buddy. This is not appropriate. And to watch these two aging white guys fight over how much their money makes them eligible to be president, sort of fascinating. And you mentioned that, you know, it's driven by consultants. This is the other thing that strikes me about how much it speaks to our moment. In addition to this guy jumping in and having all of his critiques focused at, right, basically a band of people who he thinks, anyways, are associated with Democrats, or maybe they're never Trumpers, right? Because he wants to appeal to these people by saying the Democrats are being too radical. And I think in his mind, he actually thinks there's a chance he's going to run for president and that he could do well and maybe even win. But he hasn't quite accepted the fact that all he would do would probably be helping Donald Trump win. But, you know, we talked about his advisors. One of them is Steve Smith, one of these never Trumpers. The other, a big one, Bill Burton from the Obama campaign. And, you know, the funny thing about this is you got Howard Schultz out there and he's talking about he's running because our politics are broken. Ostensibly because there are people on the right and people on the left and they disagree. And
right.
But the irony is to the extent that our politics are broken, because I happen to believe that politics are actually a function of disagreement. That's why you have politics, is because different people have different ideas about what should be going on in society, and politics is the way to resolve that. To the extent that our politics are broken, and that to me strikes me as politics working the way they should. To the extent that they're broken, it is really, in many respects, a function of the wealth inequality that this billionaire, who on a whim decides he wants to run for president, and has the ability to command basically the nation's biggest media outlets for a couple of days, particularly in this environment, I think that's a sign of what's wrong, what's broken with our politics. The other thing I would suggest that's broken with our politics is the idea that you've got these high-paid, high-priced political consultants who are, you know, egging this guy on or just yesing him to death so that he continues to race because they're lining their pockets. There's no other way. I mean, I saw a performance by Bill Burton on Meet the Press Daily that I just found fascinating. Why is this guy running for president? Well, he's really good with his family. What? Are you serious? They rolled out some line that was to the effect of it was something like we need to risk the possibilities for new possibilities, or risk the imagination for new possibilities. It's not even good pablum, right? And this is what is fundamentally broken with our politics, you know, first order, is that money has distorted the marketplace of politics. You know, political power is diminished by the massive amounts of concentrated money that we have in our society today.
Well, of course. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the, and I just don't, you know, the critique here that, you know, somehow or another, the two parties are just, you know, they're having these ridiculous squabbles, and it's just all so simple. It's just so easy. All we need is some guy who ran a business, because that's, of course, exactly the same as running the government, which I really would have thought after 2 years of Donald Trump, nobody was deluded enough to think that was true. And I'm not just talking about Trump here. Look at the other people in his cabinet. He said that he was going to hire all these fabulous, you know, titans of industry to come in and really get things done. Look at Rex Tillerson. That guy ran ExxonMobil. I mean, that makes Starbucks look like, you know, you know, my corner grocery
like
store.
Like a coffee shop.
Yeah, I mean, it does. And ExxonMobil, that guy was obviously an extremely successful executive who, you know, was unparalleled in his abilities to run a big corporation. He got into the State Department and completely failed on every level. He raised the place. He absolutely, do you remember all those people who were quitting and everybody was showing up at work and didn't know what they were doing? They assigned all the experienced people to go and do filing, and you know, I mean, it was insane. And I mean, even though Tillerson, you know, is now sort of remembered as, well, he was one of the grown ups. Yeah, he was. It didn't work out well. Those grown ups from the private sector. I mean, look at Wilbur Ross. The guy's a screaming crook. He's completely lining his pockets while he's in office. He appears to me to be a little bit past his prime. But even if he were in his prime, this guy was a big investor banker type who took over major industries and then turned them around and sold them and did all that. I mean, and look at him. I mean, he goes on TV and he has enough, you know, has no political acumen whatsoever. So, I mean, this idea of that is completely ridiculous. And the disappointing, you know, I mean, of course, these political consultants are looking for work, but geez.
Yes, it's pretty cynical. We've got to take a break. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, we got a lot more to talk about. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, Venezuela on the brink of collapse. Ivan Briscoe from the Crisis Group will be here to explain how the South American country ended up with two presidents. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Standing in the corner, studying the lights. Dreaming of escape. Could be a bad night.
Hi, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Folks, we need your support by becoming a member of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast for just a couple of bucks a week. You're going to get three times the amount of show that you get right now, and you're going to get it commercial free, and you're going to keep this program on the air, producing itself as a podcast, as a radio show, week in, week out. head over to ROFpodcast.com right now. Become a member. Get access to over 10 years worth of archives. Are you kidding me? Check it out now. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Venezuela is currently in the worst humanitarian crisis it's seen in recent history. Years of economic mismanagement, corruption, and pressure from the international community have led to the lack of basic necessities like medicine and food. Here to explain how Venezuela got to this point, Ivan Briscoe from the International Crisis Group. So, Ivan, this all basically broke out into the open on January 23rd in terms of the, I guess the question as to who is the president of Venezuela. But let go back for us and just set the table because, you know, to a certain extent, our audience in the United States, we tend to look at these issues through a rather myopic lens and the United States part in this. But this is a story that has been ongoing in Venezuela for some time, at the very least, since obviously Hugo Chavez died. But tell us, just assess for us the Maduro presidency, what its trajectory has been. And we should also state, obviously, that the problems that has happened with the Venezuelan economy have been exacerbated by the United States and others' policy towards their participation in world markets. But fill us in on that.
Okay. Well, we start with Nicolas Maduro, you know, a long-time Chavista, very loyal to his boss, was anointed as Chavez's successor, effectively, when Chavez departed for the last time to Cuba for what turned out to be his ultimate cancer treatment before he died early in 2013. Maduro took charge, won election shortly after that by a narrow margin, and unfortunately for him, presided over the beginning of Venezuela's economic decline, which was obviously produced by the falling oil prices at the time. But I think this is crucial, we have to say, Maduro and his government have run the Venezuelan economy into the ground. I mean, their economic policy has been a disaster for many reasons. But I think one of the reasons is that Maduro had to keep the show on the road, the Chavista show, something which had been totally dominated by this hugely charismatic, you know, figure, which was Hugo Chavez. Maduro is not as charismatic. And the way he went about keeping himself in power and holding the alliance of Chavistas together was fundamentally through corruption and paying off different parts of the military, of the political allies. And this has been the story of the last 6 years, if you like. We have seen Venezuela's economy crunch, decline by 40 to 50%. We've seen terrible hyperinflation in the last 2 years, the direct result of appalling economic mismanagement. And we've seen at the same time, politically, the opposition, which had really been buried under Hugo Chavez, who was, you know, just a serial election victor, enormously popular in the country. The opposition has come back, restored itself, cleaned itself up, won elections to the National Assembly in 2015. And then as it started, you know, preparing itself to, you know, finally dislodge Chavismo from power, that is when the political repression began, and the government, alas, became ever more authoritarian, resulting in the elections, the very disputed elections of May last year.
Okay, and just give us a sense. I mean, the economic mismanagement, they're mismanaging, obviously, the fall of global oil prices, which had propped up the economy significantly. Give us a, if you could, a brief survey course, though, on the my understanding is that there were implications to lines of credit that were denied the Venezuelan government and caused deeper corruption because of what was what could be done at that point with playing off of different currencies, particularly, you know, as related to the U.S. dollar.
Right. I'm going to put this straight. And I mean, I've been working on Venezuela for a long time, and I have had great sympathy with Hugo Chavez in his time, and spoken to his ministers, visited Chavista projects. You know, I have written about this in the past. So I want to say absolutely clear, I'm not coming at it with an ideological bias or a prejudice. I'm going to say it as it was. There are two sorts of sanctions which the United States has brought against Venezuela. Targeted sanctions against government leaders, asset freezes, travel bans, you know, the usual, which is now cover a lot of government leaders, but doesn't really have economic effects on the Venezuelan people. And financial sanctions introduced in August 2017. Now, those, a lot of blame has been put on those from certain sectors. And it's true that they did restrict credit lines to Venezuelan companies and for oil purchases. So it rather, you know, reduced the room for maneuver. And you speak to senior US government officials and they will admit there's been over compliance with those sanctions, so that, you know, any dealing with a Venezuelan company which involves a US bank or a financial transaction of some sort comes in for particular scrutiny. And that wasn't the initial intention of those sanctions. But I want to be absolutely clear, the Venezuelan economic disaster had gestated well before those sanctions were introduced. The emigration was already beginning. The inflation was already rocketing. The imports of food and medicine on which people depended were already collapsing. All of that was well underway. If you look at the poverty rates in Venezuela, the increase in the number of poor people from 2013-14 till 17 was absolutely huge before the sanctions. There's no doubt the sanctions have had an effect, a chilling effect, and they particularly hit the oil industry, which has collapsed in the last year or so. But I think if you are looking for a general understanding of where the Venezuelan economy went wrong, you've just got to look at price controls, distortions, expropriations, and a very lamentable manipulation of the currency, which was effectively used by people close to the regime to make vast amounts of illicit money.
Right. Okay. And so, you know, we're going to take a break in about 2 minutes, but before we do, give us a sense of what we're talking about when we talk about, and you've alluded to it a little bit, but when we talk about an economy that has really just crashed, I mean, has just imploded, what does it mean on the ground? Like, how do Venezuelans and give us a sense across the income spectrum. How do they experience it?
Well, I mean, what we mean by this is that you have a minimum wage, and that's because of the constant hyperinflation and constant devaluation of the currency has been, you know, rocking around $5 or $6 up and down according to how the currency is faring at any given moment over the last 2 years. So that's dollar terms. Obviously, you know, food is a bit cheaper in Venezuela, but not considerably. And it means that access to all those goods which are imported, and huge numbers of goods are imported. This is an oil state, it's traditionally imported, you know, most food and you know, and other goods. It means access to those is very limited, you know, indeed. So what do you see? I mean, how does it affect the people? Well, you know, I can speak from a number of different places here. You go to the border, Cucuta, the Colombian border town with Venezuela, and you see the families who are bringing all their possessions, you know, leaving Venezuela. And I mean, you see some terrible things. What can I say? You see children, 1 year old children with their feet all bent because of rickets, which, if I'm not mistaken, is due to a lack of protein consumption in their first few months of life. You see regularly people who have just consuming less than they need to be able to eat. If you go down into the far south of the country, Amazonas or Bolivar State, you know, the stories of just the compromises and the way people have to shut up and keep quiet to receive the food rations, the clap boxes, which they receive from local state authorities, and all the sorts of forms of poverty you can mention. The one thing which nobody lacks until there are occasional shortages is petrol, gas, because it's so phenomenally cheap. It's still, even despite all the massive inflation, it still kept a sort of subsidized rate of less than pennies, less than cents. In fact, I saw one estimate recently that you could fill 11 Olympic-sized swimming pools with petrol bought with $1. In Venezuela at the moment. So, I mean, this is just an example of the economic distortions. Overall, you see the effects. Now, I think the point you're also raising here is, you know, how is it affecting the richer people? Well, the
Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, let's talk about how it's affecting the wealthy as well in Venezuela. And then let's talk about the move by Juan Guaido to attempt to assume the presidency. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Ivan Briscoe. We'll be right back in just a moment.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Don't forget our podcast available on iTunes or wherever podcasts are served. Right now, I'm talking with Ivan Briscoe from the International Crisis Group about Venezuela and the uncertainty of who will be its next president. So, Ivan, before we broke, you were just giving us a sense of what the lived experience of Venezuelans are at this point in Venezuela, leading up to the attempt, we should say, and I guess ongoing attempt of Juan Guaido. He is the chairman of the Venezuelan National Assembly, to assume the presidency under a stipulation in the Venezuelan Constitution. But give us a sense, you had mentioned what it was like for folks in Venezuela. You were about to tell me the wealthy, presumably the elite in Venezuela. Where are they in terms of this, having the economy crashed?
Well, it depends whether they're inside or outside the state, alas. I mean, there are dollar incomes to be had. There are people who are still plugged into the oil industry, which is basically run by the Venezuelan military these days. The head of the state-run firm, the PDVSA, is a general, is Manuel Quevedo. You have the exploitation of gold and coltan mines in the south of Venezuela, which has grown hugely in the last few years, again with military control and traffickers and what have you. People who are in on those, the military are in charge of importing food, which is another source of abuses. The people who are in on those acts can generally get money in dollars, and so they're doing all right. But if you're a corporate executive, if you like, for a Venezuelan firm and don't have access to a dollar income, you're probably going to be on about $100 to $150 a month income, which is better than people on minimum wage, but it's not fantastic. But, you know, there is still obviously a dollarized elite, and you can see the signs of that in Caracas. You can still see, you know, expensive restaurants relatively full, even in these days.
Okay, so this state of affairs leads up to some popular uprisings. Give us a sense, and lead to January 23rd when Juan Guaido announces that via a constitutional provision, Article 233 of the Constitution, he was assuming, I guess, the interim presidency. How much of the protests, which were getting pretty violent leading up to the 23rd, how organic were these protests?
Oh, that's very difficult to say, really. I mean, there were a spate of protests. I mean, there have been protests over the years, big protests in 2014, the huge 4 months of protests in 2017. organic in what sense, that people voluntarily go onto the streets and protest without being provoked, or whether they were called by the opposition. Clearly, the gesture by Juan Guaido leading up to his self-proclamation as president has brought the opposition out of hiding. I mean, the opposition was being totally vanquished last year. They didn't know what to do. They were divided. They were demoralized. They were uncertain as to how to stop being cornered or their leaders arrested by the government. So that brought them out. So these huge marches, which you're seeing on a regular basis now, that's obviously organized by the internal opposition. There were also lots of small, I think this is what you may be referring to, those smaller, more violent protests in the Chavista bastions, the loyalist strongholds in Caracas. When you actually look at the reports, the videos, the audio coming out from there, I mean, people were not really protesting against political repression or, calling for a U.S. intervention. They were complaining about prices. I mean, it's prices because you're looking at a predicted inflation rate for this year of 10 million%. And that makes life incredibly difficult for people who just want to buy bread and their next meal. And that is the reality. But those protests in the loyalist strongholds seem to be ongoing, but often the information is unreliable from there.
Okay, so give us a sense of we have an odd situation, it seems to me, where different members of the international community have lined up on opposing sides as to the validity of Juan Guaido's gambit. Mm-hmm. And there seems, even in the context of people's assessment of that gambit, not just from an international in terms of a governmental, but it seems to me that there's also a split as to the validity of what he's doing between citing Article 233 of the Constitution, mm-hmm, as starting a process to have a new president versus him being the interim president. Give me your sense of where these fault lines are and why they might exist.
I mean, we are in a very hazy area. You can look at Article 233, and it says very clearly, if the president is not fulfilling his or her duties, if there's what's called an abandono del cargo, or sort of a vacation of his or her post, the post has been vacated because of mental the president goes missing or they're mentally no longer able to take on the post, then the National Assembly can take this initiative. Is a disputed election a premise that can allow for that article to be introduced? It's not at all clear. But then at the same time, Maduro's government has hardly been, honoring the Constitution over the last few years either. In fact, the number of abuses of the Constitution by the government is numerous. So, I don't think we can accuse Guaido of doing something the government would never think of doing. But there's no doubt it is at the very limits of the interpretation of the Constitution. But I think the other point you raise is very important. It says explicitly a 30-day interim president, which will then lead to free and fair elections. Now, the fact of the matter is, what happens when we get to February the 23rd, if there are no elections on the horizon, how does it then work? The entire assumption by the opposition, but more so by the United States and the Latin American government, is this has got to move quickly. There's got to be a rapid collapse of the Maduro government and then move on to elections. But it might not be that fast. And if it's not that fast, what sort of constitutional terrain are we in come the end of February? Could we be faced in Venezuela with two illegitimate presidents? I mean, this is the worry which we have to deal with. I think, quite frankly, the way this is now being played out, this way this crisis is being played out politically, suggests we're beyond the realm of the Constitution and are looking at politics in its raw state. So the formation of blocks of power on the ground and the quest for supremacy.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I imagine that where the military falls on that divide is going to be decisive, ultimately.
Absolutely crucial, and there's no doubt Guaido has appealed directly to the military. The military, the high commander so far, pledged their loyalty to Maduro, so that will be absolutely crucial. But the fact of the matter is the recent U.S. measures against the oil transactions will mean that within a few weeks we're going to start seeing even worse economic conditions on the ground in Venezuela with very uncertain consequences.
Ivan Briscoe, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ivan Briscoe is the Latin America and Caribbean Program Director at the Crisis Group. You can learn more at crisisgroup.org. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to support the show. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.